Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory to 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and Memorabilia on the Sports History Network. In conjunction with Swick Enterprises, we are live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails Portland, Oregon, the one, the only, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Any introduction by the captain is a good one. Do you have that memorized after all these years, Bob?
Yeah, I still mess up a few words here and there, but
Switching from Wallingford, Connecticut, after a decade, it had to be tough for the first few shows.
It was. I was caught in the Wallingford, Connecticut time warp.
I still have that memorized, Wallingford, Connecticut. I mean, it's been, how long have you, have you moved? How long ago did you move? 3 years?
No. 2021. So it's going on 4 years. Next year will be 5 years. So August 17th, 21 to be exact. And August 26th will be 5 years.
A decade of Wallingford, Connecticut, the mecca of Gridiron Greats, has been burned in my memory. So
at the old compound and at the old P.O. Box, the infamous P.O. Box 133 of Wallingford, Connecticut. P.O. Box 10281 in Southport just does not, there's no flow to that.
It doesn't have the same finesse, Wallingford. Wallingford sounds like a football mecca.
It is. Yeah. At one time.
Well, it's like Air Force One. Wherever Bob Swick is, the captain is the mecca of football collecting. So
I try. And again, this hobby is getting literally rougher and rougher by the day of what we're seeing, what's going on. And today we have one of our open forums. We're going to go and cover a bunch of different subjects that a lot of our listeners and readers have been, talking about. And the first thing I want to talk about is, and we talked about this briefly before the show, what is actually going on with pricing right now? I mean, where are we with a lot of these cards? It's amazing to me.
Well, we have a thread on Vintage Football Community, VFC. Hail to the leader, glorious leader, Jeff Payne, where we track Bronco Nagurski, 35 Chickle Bronco Nagurski prices. And we've seen, it used to be it was $1,000 a grade up into about a PSA 4 or 5. So PSA 4 nags would cost you 4 to 5, depending upon the condition. And now a PSA 2.5 sold for in the 24 to 26 range. And it was nicely centered. It had a stain on it. It's one that I used to own. And you're seeing nicely centered ones going for 10 times the grade. It's
Right,
one
right.
time the grade. God forbid, you know, if a PSA 8 hit, what was it like four or 5 years ago? The PSA 8.5 came up for auction. So there's six PSA 8 Nagurskis, one PSA 9 that was crossed over from an SGC 96, and one 8.5. I thought that 8.5 was going to go for $250,000. I mean, it went for 160,000, including the VIG, but
yep.
Still, that was 100,000 lower than what I thought it would go for. So that's
right.
If the card pops up now, it'd be $300,000.
Right, right. And again, with the scarcity and with some major collectors out there trying to increase their collections, and now they're down to the handful, which to me, I still maintain the two toughest football sets that anybody tries to collect is the 35 Chickle and the 94 Mayos. I don't care what anybody says, I still say there is a demand for those. The Mayos are beyond rare.
Yeah.
What I've been seeing lately and been private talks with several collectors, they are in shock to see what some of the Mayos are selling for. And again, that's a set which I know I'll never complete because I'll never get
well,
the Dunlop.
We discussed this a while ago, but there's rare and then there's expensive. You know, the Mayos are, you know, they're rare, but not expensive.
Right.
You know, like the Chickle, if you wanted a PSA 8 Nagurski, it's rare and expensive. You know,
right.
As much as that Venn diagram. The people who have those probably won't let them go. It doesn't matter how much money you throw at them. I sold my Nagurski 8 to Robert Casterline, who we had on the show a while ago.
Right.
And, you know, he represented the Hunt family, you know, which owns,
right.
you know, the Kansas City Chiefs. It doesn't matter, you know, to them, an extra
yep.
$20,000, $30,000, $40,000, you know, that having the card is what's important. So,
correct.
And
right.
I would imagine the other five people who own it, you know, feel the same. I think the Hunt family owns two of the six.
Right, right. They do. They do. And again, you bring up a good point. The Mayos are rare, but I see, though, now a steady increase in the price of them.
Yes, yes.
I've had two serious inquiries right now about on the, I believe I have 19 or 20 of the set. And as you know, they're graded in SGC grades from authentic to 30.
Which they should be. The Mayo looks really good at SGC.
The Mayo to me does not compare in a PSA holder. It doesn't look nice in it. In an SGC holder, I think any tobacco card, especially the Mayos, look very, very presentable, very sharp, so on and so forth. So I've been approached, and, you know, again, I have mixed feelings wanting to sell any of them. The only thing I say to myself, I only have one in a grade of 30, which we bought in, as a group lot many, many years ago when I bid with you and a couple other people, and we got a partial set of it. And you took what you needed. I got a handful out of them. And long story short, I would sell the 30 at a high price and then try to pick up that card in replacement in a 10 or a 20 and get another 10 or 20. But again, I'm not seeing a lot of 10 and 20s coming to the market. And if they are coming into the market, now we're talking thousands of dollars again. So to your point, you're looking at $1,000 per increase in the grade. So theoretically, an SGC 30 should be a $3,000 card now. And it is coming very close to that. In certain cases, the Dunlap we have to take out of the equation because that's a rare card one way or the other. I don't know what would be a fair price for, let's say, a SGC 10 Dunlap would be. 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. I have no idea. I mean,
it was a $10,000 card. The Dunlap in pretty much any grade was a $10,000 card even 4 or 5 years ago.
Right, right. So today it's probably, let's call it, a $20,000 to $40,000 card in an SGC 10 grade or a PSA 1 or 2 grade type of situation. So again, as those prices continue to increase, longtime collectors like myself say, okay, what am I doing with these cards? I'm never going to finish the set. So maybe I'll just take a Yale card, a Princeton card, and a Harvard card out of it as a type, you know, three type cards. and call it a day, and then liquidate, you know, the rest of my collection to people who really want them and who are going to collect it? Or are those cards going to other dealers who feel that they're going to make money on them, so on and so forth, in the same light as the Nagurski or any of the 35 Chickles? Because now the 35 Chickles are just, you know, astronomical as far as pricing is concerned. So again, I don't know which way the market is going. I don't know how we're viewing it. You know, you and I have a pretty strong handle on what's going on, because we are active in the hobby, and we see the hobby from a few different perspectives. We see it from a dealer perspective, and we also see it from a collector's perspective. And in that mix of the two, we also have to be smart on, okay, if you're going to offer me $30,000 for this card, I'm going to sell the card. I there's no reason for me to keep that card. You know what I'm saying? And or no, I know this $30,000 card 5 years from now is going to be a $60,000 card. That kind of situation.
But most of the dealers I've talked to can't lock up their money in speculating on cards, like buying a Mayo now for $1,000, hoping in 3 years it'll go up to $3,000. You know,
right.
They keep their capital moving.
Right.
You know, it's like if you're a drug dealer, you can't do drugs. You know, if you're a dealer, you probably can't collect that much, because you have to be worrying about, if you find a Nagurski, you have to be worrying about, you know, your price point and then flipping it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at the population of the Mayos in a long time. I haven't looked at the population of Nagurskis in a long time. And then the numbers are skewed because of people cracking out Nagurskis and resubmitting. So, I mean, anything below a, you know, whatever, an eight, you know, the numbers are off by, you know, whatever you want to decide. I mean, from people, right. I mean, I've cracked a few Nagurskis and, you know, and tried to get them regraded. And,
And again, the other question I have, and I was going to mention this, but I might as well mention it now. What's going to happen to SGC since PSA owns it?
Yeah.
Why are they keeping SGC? Is SGC just going to become a PSA, so we get rid of the SGC holders? It'll be, you know, Florida will be grading PSA type, so on and so forth. What does that do to the market? And again, because there is no communication going on, what's happening to SGC, which I think PSA does owe an explanation to say, is SGC just going to stay SGC and we're going to be, you know, PSA, or what's going to happen?
I think it's best that they keep, I mean, the perception of, you know, the people having a choice. If you belong to, you know, a community, a chat room, even the PSA chat boards, the CU boards, there's talk. If you're an informed collector, you know that PSA owns SGC. So the perception, right. The perception of choice to anyone outside of being an informed collector, it's like, no, PSA doesn't grade very good, I'm going to send it to SGC, and not knowing they're under the same umbrella. I mean, they're in different headquarters, but the quality control at SGC went up a click when it got purchased. Right. Yeah, we had a previous PSA grader, you know, Scott Alpa, on the show, and he was in Portland here a couple weeks ago, and me and my son went and had dinner with him, and he was talking about some of the grading inconsistencies at SGC when they came on. And there's a Tokyo branch of PSA now, and, you know, he flew the graders here to train them and send them back. So, you know, when he worked there, he was working on consistency in the grading. Until SGC Florida gets shut down and becomes SGC New Jersey, you know, sharing a storefront next to PSA New Jersey.
Yeah.
They're two separate brands run under the same management. You know, right. Perception of choice to the uninformed hobbyist, I guess, would be the best way to put a bow on it.
Right, right. And again, you know, longtime collectors do understand they're owned by the same company. Some collectors still don't like graded cards, like myself. Some collectors also are loyal to Beckett for whatever reason, for their gradings. The new tag grading system, which is mostly new cards, I really don't see them as, you know, any element to
agree
what's going on today. If you need a brand new card out of a pack graded for whatever reason, good luck to you. That's all I can say. And again, I've seen too many shows. That's all I saw lately over the past few years here in Wilmington area. And I just said, you know, it's just total. I mean, it's asinine to me.
Well, the show we did a couple months ago, where I was talking about the highest, I did a Gridiron article a couple years ago about the most widely collected set,
Right.
and it was the 55 tops All-American. How many 55 tops All-American cards were graded? 100,000. So, and then you get into the modern stuff. If you remember that show where I went over the metrics of how many modern cards have been graded. And it was like the 2022 Topps refractor purple chrome header, prism, had 3 million graded. I mean, a 30 multiple of any vintage number. And most of those were buried in the chase cards, I mean, I don't think you'd find many people who collect the 2022 Topps set, because there's so
And
many
again,
variations of it.
that is, very prevalent in the hobby today. So that again, dealers like myself, when I set up at a show, I'm spending most of my time explaining to the collector what I have there because they have never seen it before, and they have no clue what it is. And they use their phone app to take a picture of the card, and well, it's not coming up. Well, I don't know what to tell you that, you're going to have to trust my word to you as being a collector for 50 some odd years, almost over 60 years now. And that's what the card is, and that's what it looks like, and that's the price for it, that type of situation. So that turns me off to doing shows now, even though I did educate some people. I'm not I just don't have a person who is focused upon getting the hottest chase card in a PSA 10 for, let's say, $250, and then walking across the hall to another table and selling it for $300, and then coming back and doing it, and just that's all they do the entire show. Well, okay, so why don't you just have a buy and sell swap meet, like you used to do for cars back in the 90s or whatever. It's the same premise of it. How fast can I flip something, and how fast can I make something? And then you have the perennial breaking of a $200 box of football cards. You get this one of one card, and there's screams from the audience. Okay, so what do you do with it now? It's a one of, so I got to get it graded as fast as possible so I can flip it as fast as possible. Okay, I guess that's collecting today.
Well, so let's turn back to that. What started this conversation between you and I a couple of days ago? Because I mean, I think the best part of this job is texting, the captain of the hobby, Bob Swick, about what's going to be on the show. And we just brainstorm ideas, and sometimes there's threads on VFC that catch our attention. The latest thread was, if you could have any card, regardless of price, what would you pick? And if you notice, most of the cards that got picked weren't really expensive, other than the Nagurski, obviously, but they were very rare. So there goes the rare versus expensive. And so I took the liberty of locking and loading a few of these. Let me, oops, hang on a second. My bad.
Yeah, it's a good point. Something A card that is rare versus a card that is expensive, and one can argue, well, a one of one of this year, how rare is it when it's one of one? Therefore, how expensive could it be? Excuse me.
And the first card out of the gate was this one.
The Mayo.
The Mayo. And you just alluded to that earlier. The Dunlop. I mean, how many of these are there? Less than 10, I believe. And this one, this one's in my collection. I picked it up probably 15 years ago. It was in the Dreyer collection, the Doug and Chad Dreyer collection. And I don't know if you ever made it out to the Dreyer Museum when we would do Dreyer Fests as part of LTS.
Right. Never got there, but I did see the pictures, and incredible,
I remember
incredible.
seeing this in a display case, in Santa Barbara, where the Dreyer Museum was. And I went, wow, that'd be really cool to have. So when the Dreyer collection broke up, I was really happy to pick this up in the old legendary auctions. But so this is a rare, and as you just alluded, with the price of mayos going up, expensive. So that that one crosses the line on quite a few things.
Right.
Is
And
it is it
it is the key to the Mayo set, because again, if and again, I always say I really believe there's 50 or less Mayos out there. I really believe that. I could be completely wrong. There could be a horde sitting in some barn, you know.
What do you mean 50 or less Mayos? You mean Dunlops or?
No, in general, of each
Oh, of each,
car.
yes.
Okay, and I believe the Dunlop is even more rare.
10. Yeah,
Yeah.
10 is the number that I've heard thrown around. Yeah.
And we go with the 10 amount for the Dunlop because it had no name on it, and possibly it was discarded because the name was missed on the card, or whatever the case may be. There, it is much rarer than the other 34 cards in that set. Okay. So in something that rare, there really is not an over or great amount of interest in them for the reason that it's unobtainable to a lot of regular collectors, and they don't understand the players of that set because they're not following early
It's
Ivy League football history.
college.
Yeah, and it's
It's
college.
one. It's very rare. I mean, to me, it's a beautiful looking set. The black borders are very condition sensitive, but it's college. It's before football. There's a lot of people who don't care about Yale and Princeton and Harvard.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a very thinly collected set.
Right.
So yes, it's rare and expensive if you're after it, because like people talk about the Beecher card, but I would say less than 10% of football collectors ever would care to own a Beecher,
Right.
present included. I mean, people like, oh, I want a Beecher. Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't.
And again, how many Beechers are out there? I want to say there are a lot more Beechers than there are Mayos out there. That's my honest opinion. I would say, venture to say, I would
Totally agree.
go out on a limb saying there's probably over 100 Beechers floating out there, in private
Totally agree.
collections and in non-football collections, so on and so forth, you know.
Who was the collector that was trying to corner the Beecher market?
Oh yeah,
I think
there.
he had like 60 of them, and then he sold them all in one auction. And it's like, dude, you can't throw 50 or 60 of one card at one auction. There's only so many people
And I
who
don't understand what his purpose was to do that, other than to show everybody he cornered the market on Beechers. And it reminds me of a guy, this I'm talking about years ago, back in the early 90s. He was trying to corner the market out on Chickles. He would buy Chickles everywhere. And in those days, I had my little ad in Sports Collector's Digest. So he wrote to me like literally twice a year, "Do you have any Chickles? Do you have any Chickles?" And I really didn't. I only had a handful that I kept for my collection. And again, I started and stopped that collection three different times because I knew I could never get the nag. So anyways, long story short, here's a guy who was cornering the 35 Chickle set, and here's this other guy who cornered the Beecher market that created no Beecher market, because okay, if you own them all, what am I supposed to do? I will give you $250,000 for one Beecher, even though the card may only be worth $25,000.
And with the Chickle, it's a professional football sound.
Right.
If you're a New York football Giant fan, you're after the Ken Strong, you're after the Bird. I mean, the Chickle touches a lot more bases than the Mayo set or the Beecher, for that sake.
Right. Exactly. And that's a very good point. And again, if you're looking at that framework of 1888 to 1947, before the 48 Leaf came out and the 48 Bowman came out, there's a wide amount of cards and postcards you could actually collect,
Good point.
but there's just not a lot of collectability and or a lot of demand, with the exception of the 35 Chickle set. So if I could start my collecting life all over again, I would have focused on the Mayos, I would have focused on the Chickles, I would have focused on the oldest cards first. But then again, I had no perception. I'm a 10-year-old kid buying 1968 Topps wax packs to try to make the set. I don't know there's a 35 Chickle set. I have no perception of how old football cards are. I'm not educated in any way, shape, or form. And again,
Yeah.
it wasn't, I've said this numerous times, it wasn't until the 1970s that I actually understood that there was a complete set of football cards. So that I would have some actual fixed amount of cards to finish that 1968 top set. I did not
Huh.
know about that until the mid-1970s.
Well, that's interesting. I was lucky when I was putting together 78 and 79, they had checklists at least, you know. All right. Another card that was mentioned quite a bit of wanting to collect if money was no object. Right here.
Kenny Strong, Rogers Pete.
Kenny, yep. Rogers Pete. I mean, there's probably four or five of these that are known. Rogers Pete has four cards. One of them is the Red Grange, but the Ken Strong is this predates the 35 Chickle Ken Strong by 6 years. So if you are a New York Football Giant fan, if you are a Hall of Fame collector, et cetera, then you are after the Rogers Pete Kenny Strong. This one came up a few times. Rare, not very expensive.
Bert.
I mean, some of
And
these.
again, I will point out, with the exception of hardcore collectors like ourselves or advanced collectors like ourselves, most base collectors have no clue that there was a Rogers. What is Rogers Pete? What is the set?
Yeah.
1929. This is just it becomes a mind maze for them to figure out, well, how was that card produced, so on and so forth. Where is it? How rare it is, so on and so forth. And here's where I think there's a big difference between baseball card collectors and football card collectors. A lot of baseball card collectors are well aware of tobacco baseball cards, and I think it's because of the Hannes Wagner card. So they realize that there were a lot of cards made late 1800s, early 1900s. There's a lot of tobacco cards out there. The cost of tobacco cards now has skyrocketed. What I can remember. I still distinctly remember the Baltimore National, whatever year it was, 2012. I'm
Yeah.
there and I'm buying tobacco cards for $5 and $10 each because I enjoyed them. I liked, I was collecting some Boston stuff at the time. So I was picking up the Boston ones. I picked up some New York ones because I knew I could
Oh,
market
cool.
them back in Connecticut, so on and so forth. Today, poor tobacco cards, ungraded. And seeing at the last National, I didn't see anything for under $100. And I'm saying to myself, who's going to pay $100 for a tobacco card basically in poor condition, which should be, in my opinion, a lot less expensive? But apparently the market is now $100 for what it would probably would grade as a PSA 1 or 2 at the most. Okay, so that's a perception and a change in the marketplace at the same time.
Yeah, there's the amount of collectors. I can remember several years ago looking, and there are more people who collect baseball than football, basketball, and hockey combined. There are more people who collect football than basketball and hockey combined, and it goes in that order. But it's very exponential. So I mean, and baseball really embraces their history a lot more. Which we've talked about. I mean, it's really a numbers game. I know quite a bit of people who collect baseball cards, but don't watch baseball. They collect baseball cards because they grew up watching baseball or reading newspapers, and it scratches an OCD itch to collect. I mean, I grew up watching football, and I love collecting. So, all right, on to this. We talked about this earlier, but here is there's another big card that is rare and expensive. This is one I used to own. I picked it up from Andy Becker. Oh man, I picked it up from Andy Becker probably 15, 17 years ago. And it's no longer in my collection, but I thought it was a beautiful PSA 7 example. I remember being at the Baltimore National. I bought it from Andy. He had his kids in the bathtub, and I was talking to him as I was. We were talking about this, and I was given his name. This is way before I joined even the LTS boards, prior to VFC. So this is probably 2006 or seven. And he was giving his kids a bath. And we're talking. He's like, "Okay, here's the price." I said, "Okay." And then like a year later, I'm at the Baltimore National. I knew no one. This is probably in 2008. I knew no one, and I walk in and I walked up to Andy's booth, and I mention something, and he's like, "Oh, I'm that guy." I'm like, "Oh, you're the guy?" And we stood there and caught up for about 30 minutes because I just
Sure.
serendipitously walked up to his booth. But so this is rare and expensive.
Yep.
As we mentioned, six PSA eights, that two of them are in the Hunt family. The other four, who knows? But to pry one of these from a collection, you would need to know who, and you would need and you'd need a lot of pocket change.
Right.
You
Right.
know.
Right. And again, that goes out for if there are any, and there are still, in my opinion, still true collectors out there who are trying to collect the set, so on and so forth. It becomes cost prohibitive to try to collect it in the long run. And again, I use an example just to fast forward a little, 1952 Bowman large football. What's the key card to it and why? Card 144. Why?
144.
Yeah, it's the end of the sheet or whatever. It got cut off, whatever the case may be. Well, I think there's a lot more 52 Bowman large Lansford number 144 floating in the hobby, both graded and ungraded, than there are, a lot of other cards that are supposedly rare in the market, so on and so forth.
Good
Right.
point.
So that's another perspective you have to put in. And again, that turns people off, collectors, to finish the 52 Bowman set. I look at Mike Rich, pure collector. He is just a pure collector. It took him literally, I think he finally picked up that Bowman 52 Bowman large last year, I want to say. And when he told me, I said, "Wow, you have been looking for that card since we started trading cards back in the 80s." And he said,
Wow.
he realizes that. I mean, and
He was after a certain condition
yeah.
because the Lansford was one of the last cards I got when I was putting together, the 52. And it's mostly because I started with the Hall of Famers. So I had the Hall of Famers, which are probably the most difficult. So the Lansford, was obviously the most difficult.
Right. And he wasn't overly concerned. I mean, he didn't want a poor condition one, but he wanted something relatively presentable. And again, that was me. As I got older, I became more picky as far as condition. I go back to the 70s and 80s. If the card was in beat up condition, I kept it as a, spot holder for that number in the set.
Totally.
And then I down here, I went through my set again, and I still got like about 500 upgrades to make. From roughly 1948, well, 1948, because my 48 Leafs is in horrible condition, right up through a handful of cards in the 70s I need to upgrade because they're, I'm a little fussy. They're more X than near mint type of thing. So anyways, long story short, again, that's a card. Who's going to buy it? Again, is it rare? Is it affordable? It's expensive and theoretically rare, but I see a lot more 52 Bowman larges out there than I ever would see, a Nag or a Mayo or whatever the case,
Yeah, totally. All right. Up next, this one. This didn't get talked, or this was really one of the top cards on the list when people talked about one that they wanted, the 26 Spalding Red Grange promotional card. Now, I love this card. This has been in my collection for probably 15 years again. And I love that mine is oversized, so you can tell it's not sh cut from a sheet.
Right.
It was cut from some sort of promotional, something on it. I'd give my left nut to know what that promo card that went out to. We've seen the
Look
letter,
like.
like, "Hey, attached is a promotional card to see what it will look like. Please send us your likeness and give us your permission." We know they appealed to pro athletes to ask them to be on the Spalding set. And we know that they sent samples. So the Red Grange is assumed to be one of the promo samples that went out. So what was it? Was it an index card? Was it, or, was it an index card shape? Was it, who knows? But
Sure.
What I like about this example is it shows that it came from an oversized, larger cart, the promotion cart.
Right. I'll give
Way
her,
back.
since you're well-versed in a little background on what were the 1926 Wimbledon champion cards and why did they come out or whatever.
The Spalding, it was somebody trying to, the Spalding company, was, if you read the letter, they're trying to get kids more interested in sports,
Sports, right.
really, because they were offering no financial incentive for the
Right.
people to be part of the set, which is why Red Grange never made it. So there's this card, somewhere, probably. Who knows how he made it to the promotional card? Because CC Pyle's representing Grange,
Right.
probably a year. No, when did he join the Bigs? 24.
So it's 2 years after, huh?
So I need to know when CC Pyle was introduced. I guess I've never thought about that.
Yeah.
But so there's Grange. They used his likeness on the promotional card, and it was documented by CC Pyle that at some point he was like, "No, we need money for that." And Spalding said no, because the other athletes would then want reimbursement. He's like,
Right.
so he never made the final set. So he never made the sheet, just the promotional card. So somewhere in between, hitting the promo card and the print run, 6 months, Grange came off because CC Powell wanted money. You don't get a nickname like Cash and Carry for nothing.
Right. Exactly. And again, so there's still a lot of mystique to the Spalding sets, the Spalding set, and there's still a lot of mystique as far as finding those cards because they're so exceptionally rare
Totally
type
agree.
of thing. Which is why I always used to enjoy going into antique stores and or paper memorabilia shows that there were less actual sports card collectors going to, and perchance you might hit on a nice postcard or a nice card of some sort that would be much higher priced at a card show and or much readily understood by the dealer selling it type of thing, therefore a much higher price to it type of thing. So
But all right, and our second to the last card is I mean, there's a reason when you introduce me, you say I specialize in Red Grange and
Seattle.
something larger. Second to the last card, here we go. And this is Grange as a college athlete, you can tell when my scanner. When I lost my scanner is when I'm holding on to cards and taking pictures of them with my hand, or with my phone. So you can see, Illinois. Then this one came up from a few people's being, a card that they would want. This is another card I really dig. It's very, and star player candy. I mean, what was there like a 80, 70 or 80 football or examples of it. All college, Red Kegels in there. The Red Grange is the SPC, the 28 star player candy, is a pretty rare card. Not very expensive, but rare.
Again, that's a good example. That to me is an exceptionally rare card, or anything from Star Candy is very rare. I don't really see them, I don't see many, if any, at a show, especially even at a national type of show. So where are they? Who has them? They're all obviously in collections, and or they're still not have not been found yet, that type of situation. So again, it's interesting to see how collectors and dealers perceive certain cards. And again, as much as I pick on the new hobby or the new card hobby, I understand that that's part of our hobby. I get it. I understand that. But I think right now the disconnect is becoming more and more evident that you got a group of flippers in the hobby, meaning that they're just buying the card and flipping it as fast as possible to make money, not understanding any of the historical perspective of the game and or the cards or anything else. So that I think is playing into what's going on today. And again, as an old time collector, and I know as I get older, I have less tolerance for it. It just doesn't make sense to me seeing what I see. I mean, it's just not logical, you know.
Yeah,
But then again,
no.
I do feel good when a young kid is with his father and he says, "Do you have any Tom Brady cards?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And I show him what Tom Brady cards I have, and I still remember at Wilmington, the last show I did in Wilmington, a little kid with his father, and the father saying, "This is the first show he's ever gone to. He's a big Tom Brady fan." And the kid probably was 7 or 8 years old at the most. And he had his own little roll of dollar bills, and I know I had a couple of Tom Brady dollar cards on. So he bought two of them for me for $2. And then I said to him, "Hold on, you're going to get a bonus since it's your first time customer and first time purchase." So I gave him this, I don't even know what how to describe his more special card of Tom Brady, which was more fancy.
Good man.
Had a $5 price tag on. I said, "Here, take it." And the father and the son were all excited, and it was nice to see because
That's cool.
kids are
Well,
doing.
last but not least, the card that most people talk about right here.
I was waiting for it. I wondered when that
I'm not that predictable, am I, Bob?
I was wondering where. I mean, again, I hear from people here. Do you have any 1977 Topps
177.
Steve Largent
These
cards,
margin cards.
raw or graded? And I said, I know a guy in Oregon who probably has the entire amount printed of them.
I would be very remiss if I didn't, get some sort of larger joke in every show.
And all kidding aside, I still remember the Connecticut show. I did. I will never forget it as long as I live. And we got started, our partnership here as far as the podcast was concerned. And the guy said to me, "I can't find a nice condition Steve Largent rookie card anywhere." And I said, "You gotta be kidding me." And he said, "No, I don't. I can't find it anywhere."
That still cracks me up.
10 football guys here, they got 77 Topps football.
That still just makes me laugh because I had no idea. I was just, but I was. But yeah, I remember when I first, when I was dating my wife, Stacy, 20 plus, 22 years ago. And I was just every Largent card, raw or graded that came on eBay, I bid on.
Wow.
And I had an Excel spreadsheet tracking them because this is back before PayPal. So I'd have to write a check every single one, mail it, call it 3 days to get for them to get the check, 7 days for the check to clear, 4 days for it to come my way. So it was, 2 plus weeks before I'd see the card. So I had to track it. Had to track it by eBay ID, by name, by reference number, and I had to track it so I would know and stuff. But I would just get it and look at it and throw it in a a case that I had. But I remember showing her because I was telling Stacey I collected football cards and she's like, "Oh, let's see what you got." And I just lay out, 400 or 500 larger cards. She's like, "This is it? I'm like, just this one guy? What's going on?" So, all right. Well,
Unbelievable.
before the show, you and I were talking. I was discussing this Lawrence Taylor video where somebody puts a microphone in front of Lawrence Taylor, who's the greatest quarterback you've ever seen. And when the NFL came out with their top 100 players ever, Jerry Rice was number one. Number two was Lawrence Taylor. So I mean, the 1-2 punch there. And so when Lawrence Taylor says, "Who's the best you've ever played against?" I was telling you what his response was, and I thought it was pretty cool. I wanted to share that. Here it is.
I'm still with Joe Montana. I'm not going with Tom Brady. Why? Because Joe is the GOAT. I've played in his era. I've seen it with my own eyes. Tom Brady got all the rules on his side. You can't touch him. If you so much as touched him, they call a foul. That's ridiculous. Now let's talk about something real. Joe Montana, four Super Bowl appearances, four wins. Brady lost three. Joe played in a tougher era with harder hits, no soft rules, and no cheating scandals. Brady's been padding stats for 23 seasons, always helped by the refs. Of course, the younger fans call him the GOAT, but just because you didn't see it doesn't mean it didn't happen. Joe was different. He didn't need flashy numbers. He just won. Calm under pressure, precise, fearless. When the lights were brightest, Joe was perfect. He didn't talk about being the GOAT. He proved it every Sunday. That's the difference between greatness and hype. Hey, I'm still with Joe Montana. I'm not
There it
going with
is.
Tom Brady. Why? Because Joe is the GOAT. I played in it.
There it is.
Unbelievable, but true. And again,
number two player in NFL history saying, who's the GOAT? It's the guy who stood in the pocket under pressure, knowing he could get his head knocked off in a different system of rules. I thought that was really interesting.
Exactly. And I see in an Aaron Rodgers today, watching his twilight of his career, he still gets the one thing I do like about him, he gets on the player who missed his route or whatever type of thing, but he's still in his own way complaining to the ref, why didn't I get this call? Why didn't I get that? Come on, man. You've been playing this game for how many years? Just accept it. That's it. Not every call is going to go your way. I have to agree with Taylor. LT, again, Brady had a lot of stuff called his way. For what reason is beyond me, other than, it must have been an NFL directive, don't touch him. Don't let anything happen to the guy. He's our bread and butter, It's still, and I know I mentioned this on the show before, at the last National, they had the Tom Brady booth, the vault. It's called the
Yeah,
vault.
yeah.
So I'm in there. I'm actually in there with Eric Stang, and who's a big collector, LTS. I mean,
Easy.
so we're in there together. We're looking, and I said to him, I don't find anything in this vault appealing to collectors like us as to what we would want to do. To buy, spend thousands of dollars for this in a mass-produced collectible. I don't. It was such a gimmick. It wasn't even funny. And then when he actually went into the show, we were like halfway down from where he was, and we heard the screaming and yelling. And Brady's here. Brady here. Okay. So what do you want us to do? We're not gonna get by and see him. And that's it. And it blew my mind. But again, that's Tom Brady and Tom Brady marketing.
There's the John Unitas, there's the Bart Starr, the guys who, I mean, you remember, what is it? What was it? The two-step rule, the three-step rule, the quarterback releases, and the defensive person had two steps to them, a continuation of their movement to hit the quarterback. Very common. A release, 1-1000, two, and to get knocked on your butt by a lineman who wanted to let you know, I was breathing down your neck when you let that go. A half second longer, 1 second more, and it would have been a sack. So
Exactly.
that's just the mental part of the game. Now that's roughing the passer. 2 seconds after the ball's released, that's roughing the passer. 1 second after.
Well, even touching, I've seen some roughing the passer calls. I mean, the quarterback's actually releasing the ball and he gets hit too hard. That's roughing the passer type of thing. The play acting of the quarterback going down and sustaining the injury there type of thing. Come on.
It's just, I mean, and I've mentioned this before, but that Hall of Fame dinner, Dan Fouts, who's the greatest you ever played against? And he's like Lawrence Taylor. He would hit me so hard, if he did that on the street, it would be considered assault. And he turned to Drew Bledsoe and he's like, no offense, but Reggie White, he hit you, but the rules were different. I mean, and so you go back to Bart Starr, Johnny U. I mean, getting hit by, Ray Nitschke or something, people, Dick Butkus, who take your head off. And same thing, Lawrence Taylor talking about Joe Montana. They're both in the NFC. They would play each other, quite a bit, not to mention all the playoffs. Standing in the pocket, knowing you're about to get to whacked, whereas quarterbacks now, the game is different. The NFL at some point realized people don't want to see, 3-0 games. They want to see scoring. And if Jerry Rice gets injured, if Joe Montana gets injured, there's a lot of disappointed. There's a lot of people who don't show up to games. went to a Lakers, you know, Portland Trailblazers game a couple weeks ago. LeBron James was injured, so he didn't play. I mean, probably 25% of the seats were empty because Bron wasn't playing.
Yeah, I get it. I get it.
You
You
know.
know, it's interesting to me, and going back to our original, you know, thoughts about cards that are expensive, so on and so forth. I still take great comfort and great pleasure in the cards from 1960 right up to the before the explosion, 1988, where you only had a few brands, you had a lot of regional oddball insert. Team issue type of sets. You had a lot of nice police sets over those years, the small sets of one team. You had a lot of nice tops, Fleer insert sets of the time. You had the Fleer in action, teams in action, 70s into 88 run. You had so many nice, in my opinion, and again, I'm nostalgic, but you had a lot of things that were collectible, that could be collected. They didn't seem out of reach, and you had fun collecting them. And today it's just totally opposite, in my opinion. That is it really fun collecting? I really don't know. I mean, we still get fun. We still have fun collecting our
The
stuff.
affordability of it too. I mean,
Yeah.
it wasn't a big deal when I was 9 or 10 to get a dollar when I went to my grandma's house to walk down to the 7-Eleven and put at least a quarter of that to a football wax pack and a quarter to a Reese's peanut butter cup, obviously.
Yeah.
That's affordable. But now you mentioned it earlier, $200 for a Topps blaster box or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, but
It's not
my
much.
son doesn't have $200.
We're in the Walgreens drugstore chain this morning, and I'm looking at they have a little card display, and a pack of last year's football cards from Sage, or 2 years ago, was $7.99, and it was repacked.
$7.99.
Yeah, it was repackaged in a plastic, and I'm looking at it, and Brenda says, "Is that any good?" I said, "No." I said, "I didn't even know. I didn't even know what these cards were. And they're college. Apparently, they're college cards. They really don't have any value. They're going to the repackers. They're packaging them, and they're putting them out in retail stores. There were a few different basketball years. I don't know anything about basketball. Those were $7.99 a pack. So." You know, how many kids are with their parents and say, "Hey, can I have $8 and plus sales tax? And you know, I need $10. I need a pack of cards," type of thing. They're like, "Holy mackerel!" It's just amazing to me. Truly amazing.
Totally agree. So, okay. There it is. I found that video to be very interesting. I mean, one of the greatest I mean, everything's subjective. I mean, like he said, viewed through a modern lens. My son is constantly telling me LeBron James is the greatest NBA player. I'm like, you haven't seen, you know, Jordan, Bird. Let's not forget about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Let's not forget about, you
Yeah,
know.
Applechuck. I mean, they're a guy.
And it's the same whenever people like the greatest quarterback ever, Otto Graham is never mentioned in that breath,
Right.
but he's one of the greatest. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, and I firmly believe it goes by era. I mean, because the rules do change, you know, the game does change, it gets faster, you know, concrete Charlie Bednarik, you know, who was one of the toughest, you know, who, you know, probably wouldn't make the second string, you know, to the NFL because it's a full-time job and conditioning and training and, you know, ice baths and, you know, chefs who make their, you know, chicken breast and rice, you know, quinoa rice meals, watching calories, working out, trainers, I mean, all of it. It's a full-time job and fitness is 365 a year.
And again, there are special players from each decade of football, and we got to put that in perspective. And again, I think my decade, again, is the 1960 to the 88 time frame. The 60s will always be the most glorious time for me for football. And again, following the game as closely as I did up through the 80s, now I just see a totally different game out there, and just, you know, it's maddening to watch some of these games today. I mean, it's just not it's not pleasant, if you know what I mean. I don't have to tell you, but. And I tell you, I do feel sorry for Pete Carroll in Las Vegas right now, because He is generally a good coach. He is a very innovative coach. I know I made fun of him chewing gum all the time. That's just him being him. I get it. But he's really a player's coach, and he just doesn't seem to have any handle whatsoever on the Raiders. And it's so sad to see that. It's
Well,
just.
end of eras comes. I mean, Tom Landry unceremoniously fired. I mean, that's the tough part is how do you end it gracefully? I mean, Hoodie, Bill Belichick, one of the, I mean, our modern day Lombardi. And he realized in a year he wasn't going to get a coaching job. Why? Why wasn't he picked up? Well, I think a lot of people realized, his system needed a Tom Brady-esque quarterback. I don't know.
And it's showing right now with North Carolina here.
Oh God, yeah.
And again, I see a lot of it locally. A lot of people are not happy with him getting the money he's getting and producing such mediocre results. And again, I was just going to say, I agree with you 110%. He does not have a Tom Brady-like quarterback he's dealing with. He cannot win without a Tom Brady-like quarterback. He showed it the last few seasons Brady left the Patriots. Now, all of a sudden, the Patriots are doing quite well with a non-Tom Brady quarterback because of the coaching philosophies. So,
Well,
I
it's
think.
like the movie. It's like the movie Gladiator. And the intro of Gladiator, when the one guy turns to Kurt, to Russell Crowe, and he goes, "A people should know when they're beat."
Right.
Russell Crowe turns to him and says, "Would you?" And this is the same. A player, a coach should know when they're done.
Right. And
And
Bill obviously did not read this correctly, in my opinion. And I truly believe at the end of the season they'll work out some agreement to
yeah.
play.
Well, Pete Carroll, I mean, and whoever the Raiders GM is, they picking up Geno Smith. As a Seahawk fan, I got to see Geno.
Yeah.
Geno's somebody you settle with. And even his years in Seattle, after we let Danger Russ go, we just always called him a stopgap quarterback. If we make the playoffs, we're first round fodder. Geno Smith does not go take you to the Super Bowl. Geno Smith is a stopgap. And the fact that the Raiders not only, picked up Geno, but they pursued him. Sam Darnold was available. They passed on Sam Darnold, pursued Geno, and traded away draft picks to get Geno. Jesus. I
It's
mean,
another Herschel Walker type trade,
yeah, we didn't quite fleece him that bad, but
Yeah.
Denver, we fleeced for giving him Danger Russ, Yeah, I feel bad for Pete Carroll. He's a great quarterback. I will be forever be indebted to Pete Carroll for bringing the Lombardi Trophy to Seattle, to my team.
I agree.
And for that, I root for him wherever he goes. But it is really hard to see that reputation being tarnished in Las Vegas.
I forgot which game they were playing. I was on the local TV here. It was horrible. I really felt sorry for him. What's he doing on the side? He can't do anything. He can't get anybody motivated. Can't get anybody to
That
do.
was the Dallas game. There was Dallas at Las Vegas, and they just took shellacking. And he looked hapless on the sidelines. It was tough. It was tough to see. So,
All
oh
right. Well, I'm
well.
out of time real quick. If you're not subscribed to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you
What
waiting for?
the hell are you waiting for? What are you doing watching this podcast if you're not a subscriber?
Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We're going to be back with another show in a few days. And until that time, thanks for watching, and we'll see you then. Take care.
See you, Captain.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones, too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.